On Bajan, nobody ever knocks except a Katerin, who makes a scrupulous point of it, so John expects her round pink face when he staggers, half awake, to the front door. What he finds is the round pink face of Rodney McKay. For a moment, John thinks he's still asleep or that his brain is playing a cruel trick on him, because he's dreamed about this. Rodney showing up on the porch, yammering a mile a minute, a flummoxed Carson Beckett in tow. There would be a jumper stuffed with medical equipment parked in the field, and they would turn the living room into a lab and work feverishly through the night and consult with Atlantis on the radio. And tomorrow, or the day after, there would be an innocent-looking syringe with a miracle inside it, and Beckett would say, "Aye, he'll feel under the weather for a few days, but he's a strong lad." And Ben would be cured. All of that must be playing on John's face, because Rodney's expression goes through something complicated and strained, and he reaches for John's shoulder, though his hand doesn't connect, rushing to say, no, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean, we haven't..." And John grips the door jamb more tightly. After a beat of unbearable silence, John tries to smile and says, "Thanks for coming, Rodney." "Is he asleep?" Rodney asks very quietly, standing in the living room. Can I see him?" "Yeah," John says, leading him to the open door of the bedroom. "Go on." He nudges Rodney forward. "You're not going to wake him up by looking at him." "He's grown," Rodney whispers in awe, like he just made a discovery that will forever alter the future of mankind, and John's throat constricts achingly. "Take your time," he says, backing out of the room. "I'll make tea." When Rodney joins him in the kitchen, John has laid out a full spread of cheese, toast, and four different kinds of jam, even though the mere sight of food makes him queasy. They end up in the living room so John can watch Ben across the hall, standing side by side against the back of the couch while the tea cools on the tray, untouched. John grasps for something to say that isn't, "So, Rodney, your brain hasn't killed you yet?" "I received your subspace transmissions," Rodney says finally. "Thank you for... It was good to know what was happening with you and Taylor and..." He trails off, waving helplessly. "It didn't get you into trouble?" "As if they could have decrypted the data burst, even if they had been able to intercept it," Rodney scoffs, then softens his voice, throwing a worried look at the bedroom. "I built the transmitter and the receiver myself." "Well," he concedes, "it was retro-engineered from a Talon design, and Zelenka helped after I swore him to secrecy. But I worked out how to conceal the signal within the galactic background radiation." Rodney's mouth quirks wryly. "Is that why you didn't mention cozying up to the guy who shoved a knife through my arm? Because you didn't think the transmissions were secure?" John shrugs. "Mostly it sounded crazier each time I tried to sum it all up in a message. What did Kolya say?" "Nothing of any use. The girl who welcomed us at the gate told me all about your operation on the way here, in detail, after she hugged me to within an inch of my life. I've never met anyone who could talk this much and be this obnoxious about it, and I'm an astrophysicist." "Who else is here?" "Ronan," Rodney says. "He's getting a tour of the city as we speak. We didn't want to overwhelm you." "Oh," John says. "I didn't think Elizabeth or whoever took over my command would allow you to come, considering I'm AWOL." Rodney's expression darkens. "I have my own command codes," he replies cryptically, "and I threaten to go on strike. Since they can't keep the place running without me, Colonel Dieter, that's your replacement, by the way, had to shut up and deal with it. Besides, the DOD still owes me vacation time dating back to 1998. "Colonel Dieter? What happened to Caldwell?" "He's still in command of the Daedalus. I guess the SGC thought he'd been contaminated or something." At John's baffled look, Rodney sighs. "Look, things changed after you left. Actually, it started while you were MIA, but then you came back from the Hive ship. But when you came back from the Hive ship, you had other things on your plate, so..." Rodney purses his lips. "Do you really want to hear about this now?" John finds that yes, he does. Anything to fill up the silence of the house. "Yeah, but hold on," he says, pushing away from the couch and crossing over to Ben, who is moving restlessly under the covers. Jen lays his hand on his son's forehead and kisses his temple, testing for fever. Sitting on the edge of the bed, he strokes the soft dark hair until the boy settles back into a peaceful sleep. In the front room, Rodney helped himself to a cup of tea. "You want me to warm that up?" Jen says, sounding almost normal. "It's fine," Rodney says, then blurts, "Is he in a lot of pain?" "No." John closes his eyes briefly. "They're pretty good with that here." "Beckett was impressed by the data they sent through the gate," Rodney admits. "That's probably why they let me come. I imagine Elizabeth will want to establish diplomatic relations. Eventually." "Good luck to her," John says feelingly. Rodney is eyeing him out of the corner of his eye, so he asks, "What?" "I don't know how much you remember about coming back to Atlantis with Ben," Rodney ventures, in a tone that might qualify as tentative. "I remember enough," John says, surprised by how much bitterness remains. "I remember that we'd been tortured and starved, and Beckett wanted to put us in separate quarantine areas." "We watched Ben feed on you," Rodney points out, "right there, in the infirmary." John springs away from the couch, raking his hair with both hands, suddenly livid. "I don't care if he had fangs and you all saw him suck out my blood. I don't care that I was gone for 3 months and came back with a 7-year-old child. I certainly didn't care about anything that came out of Heitmeyer's mouth. I didn't need protection from Ben. I told them he was mine. That should have been enough for them," John snarls. "It was enough for you." "Yes, well," Rodney says, stuttering and laughing unsteadily, "you haven't met my relatives." Breathing deeply a few times, John paces across the room, stopping by the window and resting his forehead against the cold pane. The treehouse is almost invisible under a hard crust of snow. "That's not why I left," he says, startled to feel the sting of tears at the back of his throat. "Then why did you?" Rodney asks, unaccountably quiet. "I looked at us, Rodney," John says tiredly. "Oh," Rodney says, then trails off. "I've seen a fair bit of war, and I know what it does to people. Nice, ordinary, smart people. After a while, there's nowhere your mind won't go, because when they're shooting at you, and you're shit scared and exhausted beyond endurance, and the sky is burning and there's no up or down, war is about the guy behind you and the guy in front of you, about your unit, your buddies, your own priorities, because they're all you've got to keep you sane in a place that's nothing like sane. And when you start thinking that way, anything's possible. That's why we have a chain of command, because not everyone's going to snap at the same time, and we'll keep each other in line." "That hasn't worked so well for us," Rodney mutters. "No, it hasn't," John says, which isn't exactly a surprise. "You and Elizabeth and Beckett, you weren't trained for this, and believe it or not, there's a good reason people train for it. And me," he laughs viciously, "hell, I was trained for something, all right." "Shepherd," Rodney begins combatively, "would you have given us the responsibility for a child? Honestly, any child?" "No," Rodney admits after a brief silence. John had looked down at Ben, paralyzed with fear in that infirmary, and all he could think was, what if Beckett got it into his head that Ben was the key to some new weapon against the Wraith? All he could hear in his head was Elizabeth, clear as day, "I'm not ready to take any option off the table." He'd heard her say it often enough, and he didn't want to believe that it was even possible, but there he stood, half-starved and barely able to stand, years of automatic threat assessment painting everyone in the room a deep red, and under it all burned the terrifying knowledge that he couldn't take them all. "I trusted everyone there with my life, Rodney," John whispers, crouching under the window as exhaustion wins out. "I just didn't know how to trust a single one of them with my sons." It's a short time before sunset when Ben wakes up, groggy but in high spirits, and John helps him swallow a bowl of soup and a slice of buttered toast. Not long ago, John would have given anything for Ben to eat without a fuss. Now the acceptance is just another blow, a taunt from Ben's silent killer. But he suppresses the grief and helps the sated Ben shuffle to the couch. It's hard to tell if Ben remembers Rodney, who stands by the hearth fidgeting and wringing his hands and looking flustered, until Ben makes a motion for his pen and paper, and John hands them over, keeping the notebook steady on the boy's lap. John draws laboriously for a couple of minutes, before gesturing for John to show Rodney the neat column of inequalities, constants, and divisions. "You remember me," Rodney beams, and then at John. "He remembers me! See how smart my godson is?" And John can smile, too, because he remembers the hours Rodney had spent in the isolation room, lecturing on the benefits of math skills for aphasic patients, painstakingly teaching Ben, who'd sat rigidly in a corner, the grammar of mathematics on a whiteboard. "He's one of mine," Rodney denounced proudly, after Ben drew his first equal sign. It was during those hours that, silently, with his back to the camera, John had begun to plan their breakout. Emboldened, Rodney sits next to Ben, moving with excruciating care, while the boy observes his antics with curiosity and some amusement that quickly turns to alarm when Rodney springs right back up, snatching his coat off the back of a chair. "I almost forgot! I brought you a present!" He riffles through a couple of bulky pockets before producing a packet wrapped in silver foil. "Ta-da!" he proclaims, victorious. Ben's smile is blinding, and John doesn't care what's in the package. He wants to kiss Rodney right then and there. Ben manages to tear the foil off with some help, and his eyes go wide. "We use them for simulations," Rodney explains, demonstrating how the engine pods of the miniature puddle jumper will expand and retract at the push of a button. "We built a few of them after your father had a bit of a misadventure going through the gate." "Hey," John protests, "I wasn't even piloting that time." Ben giggles, opening the rear hatch, sticking his eye against the opening to look inside. "You remember that ship, don't you?" John says, shooting Rodney a look. "Did you find the jumper where we dumped it?" It had been tough to ditch their last tie to Atlantis, but the jumper was too recognizable, to the Wraith and to everyone else. "Yes," Rodney says. "I made up some cockamamie story about vetting that planet as a possible beta site, and that you were likely to head there." John nods tightly, not eager to revisit those first few weeks adrift in Pegasus and living off the land, never staying in one place for too long, before they heard of Bajan. "Who did they send after us?" Rodney snorts. Ronan volunteered and Elizabeth agreed, presumably because he was the only one who stood a chance of anticipating Taylor's moves. Caldwell objected, as you can imagine. He wasn't born yesterday, but Elizabeth overrode him. Ronan spent most of the last year and a half on walkabout across paradise planets, reporting fake sightings and visiting ex-girlfriends. "Remind me to thank him," John says, because there's no point telling Rodney that Caldwell and Dieter would have had their own men out there, ordered to remove the security risk that was John. "I know he handled the whole thing horribly when you came back," Rodney says, chin raised. "We spent weeks trying to locate the Hive ship, and when the Wraith didn't show up again over Atlantis, we really wondered. We had no idea what they could have done to you, and I'm sorry if it seemed like we treated you as an enemy. But honestly, you weren't in your right mind. Who the hell would have been? So maybe things weren't quite as bad as you remember." John chews on that while Ben sketches loops with the toy jumper. "Maybe," he says, not really believing it. "It makes no difference now." "Then why did you..." "Taylor knew what I was going to do. She showed up in the jumper bay with her mind made up. But you knew, too, and if anyone could have overridden my protocols and stopped us, it was you." Instead, Rodney had snuck into the bay after them, smiled tightly, handed over the transmitter and the dummy's guide to the Pegasus Galaxy, and made a truly terrible crack about John and the starring role in the Pegasus adaptation of Not Without My Son. Rodney's eye roll is sort of comforting. "You wouldn't believe it, but thanks to my amazing powers of observation, I noticed a certain, shall we say, pig-headedness about you, and a truly ridiculous talent for getting out of statistically improbable situations. If you wanted to leave Atlantis, you would have found a way. They couldn't keep a detachment of Marines on you forever. And if they tried to send you back to Earth like Caldwell suggested..." "Well," Rodney says defiantly, "this way, you didn't just disappear on me." They spend a rousing hour reenacting space battles in the living room carpet with the miniature jumper, a box of biscuits standing in for the Daedalus, paper F-302s, in various sizes of tin cans for the Wraith Fleet. Rodney provides the technical commentary and second-guesses John's maneuvers, and John contributes the sound effects over Rodney's complaints that you can't hear explosions in space unless the blast hits the hull. Ben tires himself out before yet another hair-raising escape, but he falls asleep with a grin on his face. "Why don't you get some sleep?" Rodney murmurs, watching John tuck layers of thick blankets around Ben. "I'll stay here and keep watch." "I'm fine," John says. "Oh, that's right, I forgot," Rodney whispers angrily, throwing his arms up. "You're always fine. God forbid the Almighty Shepherd should ever need a little help from his friends." That stings, even though it's Rodney, and it should bounce right off. No one who's ever been in battle wanted to go through it alone. No one, not even John. The lack of repartee must be getting to Rodney, who rushes to explain. "We haven't been under siege for months. It turns out that the city really is a yo-yo, so the Wraith who come sniffing around find only ocean. We're looking into the saltwater intolerance, by the way. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not particularly short of sleep, and I'm sorry, but you look like death." Rodney gestures at the king-sized bed and the small bundle lost in the middle of it. "Just get in there with Ben and shut your eyes. I'll be right here. You can trust me." John doesn't even know why he's fighting. "Yeah, okay." He's too tired to do more than brush his teeth perfunctorily and take off his shoes, before gently moving Ben to the right side of the mattress and stretching out next to him. After taking a turn in the bathroom and turning off all but the bedside lamp, Rodney settles against the headboard, his thigh brushing against John's back. "Rodney," John says, eyes closed. "Yes," Rodney says, patting his shoulder awkwardly. "I know." "How long can you stay?" John asks Rodney in the morning. "However long I damn well please," Rodney says airily, as if he hadn't just brought them breakfast in bed. "I've thought about what memory to contribute to your underage girlfriend's residency scheme. As it happens, I still have a few words of wisdom to impart on the subject of leadership." Mid-morning, Ronan finds his way to the house, arms loaded with groceries. Ben looks the big guy up and down from his nest on the couch, but doesn't seem put off by Ronan's sheer presence. "You look like shit, Shepherd," Ronan tells John over an early lunch of brown beer and Satidan meat casserole. Ronan's kitchen manner is frankly terrifying, even if he didn't pull all the carving knives out of his hair. "So I've been told," John says, smiling faintly. "Thanks for, you know, sucking at your job." "Don't mention it," Ronan says, shrugging. "I don't like the new guy." That draws a real smirk out of John. "I've been gone for almost 2 years. I don't think you can call him the new guy anymore." Ronan eyes him over a loaded fork. "He's new. He thinks our battles are like the battles he fought before. It's not personal for him. He doesn't understand the way things are." "We were audited," Rodney interjects, mouth half full, clearly picking up a long-standing argument. "I've explained this a million times already." "Come on, buddy. I swear it tastes better than it looks," John says, coaxing Ben to eat a small spoonful of casserole. "Audited?" "Yes, by the Pentagon and the International Committee. Consider that in the space of a few months, we managed to turn our military commander into a bug, turn a Wraith into a human, get suckered by said Wraith into giving away the location of Earth and the means to get there, lose our military CO, get him back, and lose him again. Do you have any idea what it costs to fly the Daedalus back and forth like that? A lot of taxpayer money. And that's not even getting into the thing with Kavanaugh. Of course we were audited." "Thing with Kavanaugh?" Ben took in Rodney's tirade bemusedly and stopped chewing, so John nudges the boy's jaw with the tip of a finger. Ronan throws Rodney an unreadable look, which Rodney ignores with a huff. "Actually, it happened the first time you went missing. Kavanaugh went around the SGC in Area 51 telling everyone who would listen and everyone who wouldn't that we'd lost it and were torturing our own out there before they could slap a non-disclosure order on him. It's hard enough to convince smart, self-preserving scientists to make the trip to another galaxy without scaring future recruits before they've even been told about the, oh, life-sucking aliens." "So what happened?" After the audit? Rodney makes a twirling motion with his hands. The scientists got slapped on the wrist and sent to their rooms without dessert. The military got a new CO. The senior staff was recalled to the SGC for a tongue-lashing with all the trimmings, and we learned to put up with as much micromanaging as Earth can get away with a whole galaxy away. The only reason we kept our jobs at all is that the Pentagon and the committee were trying to stick it to each other. Is all that John can think of to say that's not, at least you're still alive. You heard from Taylor yet? Ronan asks, obviously bored with the topic. This time it's Rodney who throws Ronan a look, though there's nothing unreadable about it. No, I... John scrubs his face with the hand that's not holding Ben's spoon. I don't even know what Kolya's doing on Dagon. I should find out if there's a way, because Taylor should be here before... Shepard, Rodney starts. I should be doing something, John says, breathing a little faster. You are, Rodney says firmly. You're doing your job, and you're the only one who can do it, right here. I'll go back to the city, Ronan says. A Katarin will take me to Kolya's men. I'll find out what's happening. I have my radio, Rodney says, pulling an ear set out of his front pocket. You know Beckett. You know he's working around the clock. He's got all the data you sent, plus all of your old medical records. He won't give up. Yeah, John says, but he avoids looking Rodney in the eye, pressing his forehead to Ben's hair and stroking the boy's back. If they were on Earth, there would be friends, relatives, complete strangers coming up to him with casseroles and stories about nephews and cousins and sons of neighbors who had survived the exact same thing. So John shouldn't give up hope or believe the doctors, because they didn't know how resilient people could be, how unpredictable. But this isn't Earth, and there's never been anyone else like Ben. They don't mention Beckett again, even when a harried-looking technician comes around to collect new samples from John and Ben. Rodney drills the man to within an inch of his life, and John makes himself listen to the answers. No progress, no change. No medical miracle, but at least no pain. John measures relief in whole new increments these days. When Ronan returns from wherever a Katarin sent him, he looks at John oddly. That's some operation you're running, Shepard. It's not my operation, John says, which gets him a stranger look. Did you learn anything? I have the coordinates for Taylor's handler, Ronan says, and John wonders who he had to beat up for that information. Hopefully Theo. I'm going now. I'll bring her back, he adds, as an afterthought. Don't worry. After Ronan departs, John settles Ben down for a nap, puts on his coat, and joins Rodney on the porch, clutching the baby monitor Rodney cobbled together from an old radio. He's asleep again, John tells Rodney needlessly. Rodney nods from the deck chair, a blanket pulled up to his chin. How did you manage to look after Ben and go out with Kolya at the same time? He asks curiously. I didn't, John says. Go out with them, I mean. Not until we started moving people off planets. He frowns. Good thing, I guess. I know life's cheaper in Pegasus, but someone's got to stop these guys from going kamikaze each time a dart shows up. Can I get that in writing? Rodney asks, staring at him. What? Never mind. After a long silence only broken up by Rodney's fiddling with the blanket, John considers asking for gossip, for Rodney to recite the table of elements, for Rodney to talk about anything before the white hush of the world and the baby monitors smother John completely. But Rodney says, staring over the open field, "It's really pretty out here. I never pictured you for the type to settle down in a quaint little house by the shore, but I didn't picture a lot of what's happened." I was an army brat, John says, calmer already. I had all kinds of homes growing up, on bases all over the world. Then I joined the Air Force and just kept hopping around. I don't think I ever pictured anything for myself at all. So Atlantis was just another home? No, not just another home. John flashes Rodney a small grin, shrugging. Just not the last one. Rodney nods like he understands what John meant. And maybe he does. You know, If there's anything I should be doing, if there's anything you need me to do, you have to tell me, because I suck at this.
You really don't, John says, catching Rodney's eyes. Then he drawls,
Actually, you could do something about the plumbing in the bathroom.
By the end of the week, Ben no longer has the strength to make the trip to the couch or sit up at the table, though he's still awake and alert some portion of the day and watches his father with a wise indulgence when John fusses over him.
Don't lose it, John thinks, sitting in the tub with Ben in his lap, gently sponging the thin shoulders and the narrow back. Don't you dare lose it in front of him, you asshole, you fucking bastard. Don't you dare do this.
Ben's head lulls softly against his chest, and small fingers reach out to touch John's hand. At night, John sleeps little and badly, startling himself out of formless dreams to check that Ben is still breathing. A caterer comes around every day bearing prepared meals, and John asks her to stop knocking, because he can't help hoping for news each time he finds her standing at the door. And the hope, so foreign, is killing him. One morning the walls close in. There is nowhere to go but down to the bottom of the endless chasm that's opened in the middle of him, so John stands in the yard and lets the cold take him, hold him there and keep him still. Too soon Rodney hunts him down, pushing hot drinks into frozen hands and nagging like a Jewish mother, strong arms dragging John forcibly inside.
Take that, Rodney orders, handing him a pill and a glass of water. It won't knock you out, but it'll help you sleep.
The world is starting to shine around the edges, so John goes with it, curling himself around Ben, this small wonder that he's made, this improbable creature that came out of hell and slipped with him inside his skin. John wills his mind to stillness. When John wakes up, Ben is blinking sleepily at him, nestled in a patch of sunlight. Hey, funny little monkey, John says, making Ben smile. The boy's only ever known monkeys from John's stick figures. I think the treehouse needs a new coat of paint. What do you say? In the living room, the armchairs are dragged in front of the large square window open to the yard and the melting snow. Ben is swathed in blankets and propped up by half the pillows in the house.
Two PhDs and this is what I get, Rodney complains, hauling containers of paint remover out of the tool shed. Do I look like a handyman to you?
Shut up and strip, John says, rolling up his sleeves. Once the wood planks have been scraped clean, John hands Rodney a wide brush and climbs through the window, tracking mud on the carpet. Ben dozes on and off through the adult's antics, but comes awake when his father drops in a chair.
Now's the best part, John says. We get to boss Rodney around.
For the next hour, Ben points at a homemade primer when Rodney aims his brush at the treehouse's roof or door or window frames, and John calls out the colors, obnoxiously enough to provoke Rodney's theatrical huffs and puffs and his increasingly graphic insults, which have John covering Ben's ears. Ben wears himself out moments before new clouds gather and the sky splits open, but John keeps on shouting saturations and undertones until Rodney wises up and stomps back inside the house, dripping purple rain.
You are such an asshole, Rodney hisses low out of deference for Ben. Magenta clashes horribly with...
Shepherd? He's across the room in a heartbeat, squeezing John's shoulder.
John? What am I going to do? John says, hiding his face in his hands. God... Rodney, what am I going to do?
The following day, they organize a trip to the beach. Rodney rigs a heating unit for the minnow. They don't even leave the car. The day after that, a caterer volunteers her own ship, a slick arrowhead that can cover the distance between John's house and Bajan in a few minutes, and they all go up, John at the stick, Ben strapped in the co-pilot's seat, eyes wide as saucers and struggling against the pull of an unnatural sleep. They cruise over the farms and watch tiny transports zigzag over the fields, beaming away piles of grain as high as small hills. John takes the arrowhead through a couple of sedate loops, which have Ben murmuring in awe. Rodney doesn't even remark on the lack of dampeners, too busy out talking a caterin in the back seat.
So the upload destroys the original memory and the download destroys the leech. Fascinating. I wonder whether each neural arrangement has a unique resonant frequency.
As for your iris, come on, little girl. You call that a gate shield? On the way home from the airfield, Ben kisses his father on the cheek and falls asleep clutching his toy jumper. In the morning, Ben refuses to wake up. Rachel Shepherd's last letter to her son read, Baghdad, 24th March, 2004. Dear John, I've been thinking about you all day. You are never far. Whatever you may think, out of mind, out of sight, isn't the Shepherd family motto. This morning I escaped my handlers to visit with the Marines of the 3A. You can imagine the stir I caused in the barracks, a USAR brigadier general, a woman, mixing it up with the boys. How is it that I always forget how young they are? A French television crew was there, 6 months into a year-long documentary on the unit. A lance corporal stood in front of the camera, smoking, talking freely about going out on patrols, about a care package he'd received, about returning home to his wife in Missouri. He worried that his tour would be extended again. He discussed the prospect of injury frankly and in short, intimate words. He didn't fear disability or the loss of a limb as much as returning home a man his wife couldn't love, a father his son couldn't be proud of. You hear about it all the time, he said. Kids signing up to see some action and coming back empty. You would like it here, John. You've always loved places more easily than people, but I'm glad you aren't here, and I won't apologize for that. You are the joy of my life, John. Never forget that. Love, Rachel Shepherd. John. He hasn't closed the curtains. Ben deserves sunlight more than John deserves darkness. The innocuous scarabs have given way to feeding tubes that snake across the bedspread, and John's dragged a chair as close to the edge of the bed as he can, bending over the mattress, Ben's small hand in his fingers in Ben's hair. He talks as he did on the hive ship those first few weeks of Ben's life, stories full of color and adventure. Rodney shuffles in and out of the room with food and drink, stricken but brave, offering to take over, to let John sleep, go for a walk, go break something. But all John has is this economy of movement, this denial of time and space and causal chains. Earlier, John unbuttoned his shirt and pressed Ben's right palm to the middle of his chest. He counted to 10, to 20, but nothing happened. John, I am here. Slim arms, strong arms twine around his shoulders, and skin both firm and yielding presses against his cheek. Taylor, John breathes. He is trapped, grateful, shaking. He doesn't resist her embrace. To fight her now would be to keep going until he'd torn away all the layers of skin, shredded all the flesh, broken all the bones against the walls of his cage. I am here, Taylor says, an answer to the only prayer that means anything. You are not alone. Ben passes away quietly, peacefully, 2 days later. If not for the soft wail of the monitor, John might not have noticed until the body grew cold. For a moment, John stands in stark panic, willing the technician who rushed inside the room with the rest of his team to do something, to fix this, to bring his son back. But of course, all the monitors read a blank. It's not really Ben's heart that gave way, or his lungs. It's his brain. Ekaterin has explained this with unremitting patience every time John asked. There is nothing to bring back. John stands by the bed for a long time. He doesn't know what's on his face, but no one reaches for him, and he's fleetingly grateful. Taylor says something which doesn't register, and that bothers him, because he's always been the guy who could keep his head through shock and injury and sudden change. He says something back. It's all right. I'm okay. Just in case. It seems a safe enough bet. Rodney looks lost and heartbroken. Everyone files out of the room. Disconnected from the tubes and the monitors, Ben looks asleep, his skin flawless and pink. The illness took him so fast, he didn't have time to waste away. John almost reaches to touch Ben's mouth, Ben's chest, to make sure. This is death unlike any he's ever seen. There's nothing at first, no thought articulate enough to be grasped, or too many to make sense. And then this. I'm still Ben's father.
That sounds right. That makes sense. There are things John needs to do, things he can do for Ben, responsibilities that are his alone.
He needs to pack Ben's things away. The bedroom they shared is littered with Ben's toys, Ben's child-size pants and shirts and shoes mixed with John's, his paintings tacked to the walls, his notebooks in a messy pile on the nightstand, the toy jumper balanced precariously on top of it.
John's going to need boxes, a lot of them. He fetches his black turtleneck from a drawer and spreads it over Ben. It was Ben's favorite, and the room is getting cold, though the sun is still shining abnormally bright for a Bajarian winter. He tries to straighten out in his mind how many boxes he's going to need. He'll want to pack up the whole house. He can't stay here. Of course not. That means Ben can't stay here, and he has to decide what to do with Ben.
John is really tired suddenly, and sunlight spills warmly across the bed, so he lies down on top of the bedspread next to his son. He stretches a hand over Ben's blanket-covered stomach. He closes his eyes. He opens them again. His chest hurts dully, like it did after the bitch fed on him and gave it back, except this time she gave it back wrong, and the pressure doesn't go away. That's what he always thought breathing hard vacuum would feel like, your body bursting with emptiness, swelling around a void. He tells himself that he should have been better prepared. He's had plenty of time to see it coming. The house should have been packed away and ready. Then he wouldn't have anything to do but lie with Ben now. But he isn't ready. He told Tyr that he might never be ready, which only goes to show that you should never say never. Tyr, Chaya, his mother, they were ready. They were the smart ones. Women always were. Who'd known that life came down to breathing vacuum. Who had said, "Screw that. We're doing it on my terms." "I'm sorry, Mom. I'm sorry." He lies on the bed watching the sunlight climb from Ben's stomach to his shoulders. He is dimly aware of the loud whispers on the other side of the door before Rodney walks in.
"Hey," John says.
"Hey," Rodney says, rather lamely.
"You need something?" John asks, and Rodney looks, of all things, embarrassed.
"Well, no," Rodney says, fidgeting nervously, throwing a look at the sweater laid over Ben.
"You've been alone in here a while, and a Katarin..."
Rodney takes a deep breath and steps up, touching John's shoulder.
"You have to let them take care of Ben now, okay? Come on, John."
He pulls John up, and John is too tired to resist.
"Let them look after him. He won't be alone. Taylor will stay with him."
John grips Rodney's wrist, remembering. "Don't let them bury him here, okay? We're not staying here."
"No, no," Rodney says, startled. "No one's going to... We won't do anything without you."
"Okay," John says. "Good. I need to find some boxes."
"Boxes? No, don't worry about that."
Rodney sounds miserable.
"There'll be time for that later, after you've had some real rest."
"Yeah," John says, rubbing his forehead. "I wasn't prepared."
"That's all right," Rodney assures him. "That's what we do best, right? Make it up as we go."
John doesn't know how it happens, but a moment later he's in Taylor's darkened bedroom with no memory of getting there, sitting at the foot of the bed, and Ronan is pulling off his shoes.
"Lie down, Shepherd," Ronan says. "You're tucking me in?" John says, struck by the surreal notion of Ronan Dex putting him to bed. "Do you want me to?"
"No, I'm fine." He hitches his way up the mattress and curls in on himself, cold but too exhausted to pull back the covers, limbs heavy as lead. The last thing John is aware of is Ronan, taking off his coat and spreading it like a blanket over him. He wakes up sluggishly to a mouthful of cotton and back muscles that are tight and aching, but he remembers Ben's death instantly, no merciful interval of confusion or denial between the dream and the reality. He turns his face into the bedspread and breathes shallowly, his world narrowed to moist heat and darkness, feeling invisible, unmoored, until instinct, unhampered by grief or exhaustion, alerts him to another presence in the room. Pushing back the heavy leather coat, John turns on his side to face Ronan, crouched in a corner by the door.
How long did I sleep?
4 hours, Ronan says, not moving.
You didn't have to stay.
Ronan shrugs.
Is this how it's going to be? John asks. You're going to watch me every minute of every day?
You can do what you want, Shepard, Ronan says.
Good, John says, hauling himself up, because I have to take a piss, and you're not invited.
In the bathroom, he empties his bladder, washes his hands, and drinks water from the tap. The mirror clamors that he urgently needs a shave, a haircut, a shower, and a change of clothes, but he can't even conceive of walking down the hallway to his bedroom to fetch his kit and a clean shirt, and have to face the empty bed. Stepping out, he finds underwear, pants, and a sweater folded on a chair.
McKay brought them, Ronan says. There's tea in the kitchen.
John pulls his shirt over his head. He arches an eyebrow when Ronan stands there watching him, but continues to strip.
Thank you for bringing Taylor back, he says, head down, undoing button and zipper.
We tried to get here sooner, Ronan says, and John is surprised by the depth of regret behind the words.
She got to say goodbye, John says quietly. If Ben was aware at all, then he knew she was there.
He takes off pants and boxers and pulls off his socks.
He clears his throat. Where did they take him?
To the medical center, Ronan says. Ekaterin said you could go when you wanted.
John nods and finishes dressing.
He follows Ronan out of the bedroom, but stops in the corridor, struck by the unnatural stillness of the house.
Where is everyone?
Outside. Come eat something.
No. What's going on?
Kolya's here, Ronan says. John steps down the hallway toward the front door, trailed by a self-appointed shadow. Bajan's primary sun is sinking below the horizon, stretching deceiving shadows across the world. There's no one on the porch, but voices are coming from around the corner of the house.
Blackmailed him into your little scheme. The man throws himself in front of nuclear weapons on a good day. What do you think is going to happen now? If you need tactical support, let me contact Atlantis and leave Shepard out of it.
I don't trust the Atlanteans. I trust Shepard.
And I'm sure that revelation would make his day if... Oh, wait! His son hadn't died a few hours ago.
Not so loud, John says, rounding the corner.
Rodney jerks comically at attention. Shepard, how much did you...
He throws a murderous look at Ronan over John's shoulder. Some kind of sheepdog you are.
It's fine, Rodney, John says softly, taking in the group assembled under the treehouse. Kolya and Nofert stand tensely across from Rodney and Taylor, and Ekaterin sits in the door of the house, legs swinging back and forth. She lets herself drop to the ground, and she walks up to him, but doesn't claim a hug.
John.
She looks terribly young, lips pale and face scrubbed clean of all color.
John.
John shakes his head, but makes himself touch her shoulder briefly.
Shepard, Kolya says, eyes dark. Please accept. Tell me what's going on,
John cuts in. He avoids Nofert's gaze, looking to Taylor and Rodney for answers. Taylor's eyes are red-rimmed and tired, but evaluating, and Rodney glares at her, as if he could force her to remain silent by sheer force of will. But Taylor has never been one to protect John from harsh truths, not even now.
Our strategy worked as we had hoped, she says, quelling Rodney with a look. The two hives have entered into open conflict. I left the ship in the midst of the battle. It was a long engagement that drew in the totality of both fleets. I remained on a nearby planet until the outcome was known, and learned of it from the worshippers sent to scout that world for new supplies. She says the world sharply, the horrors she witnessed lurking under the mundanity of language. Michael's hive was victorious, though it sustained significant damage in the initial attack. The strained lines around her mouth soften. That is not all I learned.
Tell me, John says, though he already knows.
Taylor, Rodney objects, his mouth angled sharply downwards. Please, don't...
It appears the Wraith have stepped up their efforts to produce more humans, Taylor says.
Oh, that's clones, Rodney snaps, voice tight with anguish. She's talking about clones.
The Wraith have been cloning...
But he can't seem to get it out. In twilight, the cheery treehouse has faded to gray, and the eye strains to glimpse the stubborn patches of snow huddled in the yard's corners. 5 black birds stand in a row at the edge of the woods, like sentinels unmoving, and John feels their eyes on him. "Ben," he says. They cloned Ben.